In this epic part two interview with Jack O'Halloran, we discuss what he actually knows about the infamous disappearance of Jimmy Hoffa. You heard that right. We also discuss what would have happened if Jack fought none other than Muhammad Ali. Man, oh man, buckle on up for this exclusive part two. Any regrets on any of the things growing up, and any regrets in your life that you would change?
That's a good question. You know, you never try to look backwards. You always try to look forward.
Yep.
And you can't redo what you've done already in your life. You can only learn from it, you know?
Okay, fair enough.
And I learned a lot of lessons, you know, and like this show is for people to see where the lessons were. And I learned a lot of lessons and saw a lot of things happen and watched a lot of transformations of this country. What, you know, different things that happened in the course of them. Hoffa was a good friend of mine. And they, just to show you why we're going to do what we're doing in the miniseries, is that they just did a movie called The Irishman.
Yep.
And that's total fallacy. I mean, I knew Frank Sheeran very well. I had an altercation with Frank Sheeran in Philadelphia. That's where he's from. And he was a driver of Hoffa, and he worked for Russell Bufalino, who I knew very well. And Frank Sheeran, I guarantee you 1,000%, Frank Sheeran never killed Jimmy Hoffa, and he never killed Joey Gallo, as the movie depicts that he did. Now, did he kill a few people? Yeah, he did. He hit a few people for under contract law, and they wrote a book about it called They Paint Houses, you know, that he was a hitter. And Sheeran had a temper, and he was a big guy, and, you know, boom, Bob's your uncle. But did he kill the people that they professed in that film that he killed? No, he did not. No one's going to find Jimmy Hoffa ever. I can tell you that right from, I know, they're never going to find Jimmy Hoffa. He's not buried anywhere. Nobody's going to dig him up. You know, it's just not going to happen. And Hoffa was an amazing individual. I loved Jimmy Hoffa. Jimmy was a man's man. He would never ask you to do what he couldn't do himself. And for them to put him in jail for what they put him in jail for, it was total another error in our society, okay? For them to say that he stole $8,000 from a Teamster fund that would never have been there if it wasn't for Hoffa. Hoffa created the Teamster fund. And if Jimmy wanted something fixed in his house, there were people that would have lined up and done it for nothing. He didn't have to employ anybody or beg anybody or steal money to pay somebody to do it. That's all bogus.
Well, Jack, I'm hesitant to ask you this question, but it's the question that anybody listening to this right now would want me to ask. And you made a big statement. No one's ever going to find Jimmy Hoffa. Why not?
Because I know where he went.
Good answer.
One day that'll come out, but I guarantee you one thing, he was never buried anywhere.
All right. Let's get into your life as a boxer, because that fascinates me. You won your first 16 fights. You fought some pretty interesting people along the way. A lot of people that Muhammad Ali actually went out and fought. You fought Joe Bugner. You fought Ron Lyle.
Yep.
You fought Ken Norton, and you fought this guy that sold an awful lot of grills,
George
Foreman. So tell us about those fights, and tell us.
Well, you know, I was supposed to fight Ali. Ali and I became very good friends. And I, as an athlete, you never, he would have been great in any sport he ever participated in. He was a great athlete. And he was a good friend. I kind of really liked Muhammad. And when I was in San Diego and I won the California heavyweight champion and I had whacked out a few people, I was in line to fight for the title. And Ali and I were made a deal that we were going to fight in San Diego. We had the deal already done. The guy that owned the arena down there was a Canadian guy, and he was new to the town, and he had a lot of money, and he was going to promote the fight. And Norton was owned by two very wealthy men, Bob Byron and Art Rifkin. Bob Byron owned most of La Jolla, and Art Rifkin owned Coca-Cola down in the franchise in California and a lot of other. And when it came out that I was going to fight Muhammad Ali, and you know, I fought Norton in San Diego, and I trained, I think, a week for the fight. I was in New Jersey and I had a lot of problems with the union.
Trained a week for the fight against Ken Norton? A whole week?
I was in New Jersey and we had some problems with the unions, a couple indictments floating around and stuff. And a guy called me on the phone. And he said, you want to fight Kenny Norton? I said, where? And he said, San Diego. I said, when? He said, next week. I said, send me a ticket. He said, you'll take the fight? I said, send me a ticket. Because I wanted to get out of New Jersey. You know, it was a reason for me to go. And so I went out. And I trained a few days in San Diego, and Norton and I had a war. And in the ninth round of the fight, you know, people were standing on the chairs. It was because I gave him a pretty good lick. They were standing on the chairs screaming. And they took the guy three or four times ringing the bell before the round, before the referee could finally separate us. We were in the middle of the ring fighting like crazy. And they separated us, and I was going back to my corner, and Kenny ran across the ring and hit me behind the head and drove me into the ring post. And the commissioner, Joey Almas, was sitting right at ringside. He jumped up in my corner and said, if you can't continue the next round, you just won the fight. And I was furious. I said, you know, and well, stupid. It was a dumb on my part. I should have sat on a stool and just took the decision that way.
Yeah, you wanted to go in and clobber him right after that.
Oh, I wanted to go.
You don't want to take it the easy way.
But I come out in the 10th round, and I said to myself, what am I doing? I'm in Norton's backyard. They want him to fight Ali. And am I crazy or what? And the fight went the distance, and he got the decision. But I won the town. People just went crazy over the licking I just gave this
guy. If you had won, you had have fought Ali?
I'd have fought Ali, yeah.
Could you have beaten Ali?
Well, there's a good story for you. You know, he and I talked about this several times. And I fought, and there was another guy, you know, I was in California, and it was towards the end of my career almost. And they had taken my license away in California for a short period of time, supposedly over organized crime. I was supposed to have been involved in something, but turned out to be bogus. But they called me from Detroit and they said, would you fight Alvin Blue Lewis? And Alvin Blue Lewis had won 13 rounds with Ali in Ireland. And then he came home and he beat Ernie Terrell and he beat another guy. And they're looking to make another Ali fight with Alvin Blue Lewis. And the promoter in Detroit called me and said, would you fight him? Because he was supposed to fight Buster Mathis, and Mathis couldn't get a license in Michigan for some reason. And I said, absolutely, send me a ticket. He said, you'll take the fight? I said, absolutely. It was like an 8 or 9 day notice. So I flew out to Detroit, and I was in pretty good shape. I wasn't in bad shape. Well, I'd been training because of this problem with in San Diego, and I was housed so I couldn't be seen on the street too much till I cleared up the problem. So I was training, and I went there, and I was in pretty decent shape. And Eddie Futch sent a guy down to the gym to watch me work out to see what they were dealing with. And I stood there and did an hour on the speed bag, an hour skipping rope, and then I did a couple rounds of sparring. And this guy went back and told Eddie Futch, this guy's in pretty good shape, man. You ain't gonna.
Eddie Futch, who wasn't he Joe Frazier's trainer?
Yeah, and he also trained Alvin Blue Lewis. Mm-hmm. Eddie was a pretty good trainer. And they ran the Kronk Gym out there in Detroit.
So, is there anything you would have done differently in retrospect to train differently?
Well, I'll tell you this story. This is where it ends at. Yeah. So, I beat Alvin Blue Lewis badly. Right. I beat him 10 out of 10. And I don't think he ever fought a guy. So I go back to Ali's camp, and he and I walk into camp, and he says to me, Jack, he said, all the press was there because he was training for a fight. Come on, let's go in this room over here. And we go in this training room, we close the door, and we're kicking the door and punching it like we're fighting. The press thought we were in there having a rhubarb.
Classic
and
Ali.
We're yelling at each other and screaming and all that stuff. And he said, "What's the look on their face when we open the door?" And we open the door and we're laughing. And these guys are all serious. They thought they were going to see this medlem, you know. So then we sit down to eat dinner. And he said to me, "Jack, if I give you a title shot, are you really going to try and beat me?" I said, "Let me tell you something, son. For the first time in my career, I will go to camp like you do. And I will train for a couple months. And when you come in that ring to fight me, you better bring a gun because you're going to need it." And he said, "Two steaks, please." You know, it would have been an interesting fight. It would, because I would have trained properly and it would have been fun. It would have been fun.
How about George Foreman?
George, I trained 6 days for. He called me on
goodness.
The phone. I was in Philadelphia and I was in
and was that the mean George Foreman? The old days George Foreman when he wasn't the grill guy and he was
he was a young kid. He was a young kid and I was beating him. You know, the fight is actually on YouTube. You can watch it. And I was beating him the first couple of rounds of the fight, and I walked into a punch. My own fault, you know, he hit me, and I went down, but I got up, and that's what really made me angry, because as soon as I went down, they stopped the fight. And I got up, and the fight was over, and George knew it. George would never fight me again. We had a good time.
You know? Who was the toughest fighter, hardest puncher, toughest fighter?
Wow, that's a good question. I think the guy that hit me the hardest in my career was a guy called Cleveland Williams.
Yep. He fought Ali too, right?
Cleveland Williams, they called me up to fight a kid named Terry Daniels, who was a ranked fighter out of Ohio, but he was boxing out of Texas. And they were looking for a white guy to fight Joe Frazier at Houston Astrodome. So the promoter, Lou Viscucci, calls me on the phone. He said, "You want to fight Terry Daniels?" And I said, "Sure, send me a ticket." So I get down there and the guy said, "My God, you're in great shape." I said, "Well, aren't you supposed to be in shape when you come to a fight?" And he said, but. So I destroyed this kid, Terry Daniels. I knocked him out in the third round. And I'm going back to Philadelphia on a plane with Yank Durham, who's Frazier's manager. And he says to me, "Jack," he said, "you beat one more good fighter, you can have the Frazier fight." I said, "I'll tell you what's better." I said, "You name the place and the fighter, send me a ticket." He said, "Are you serious?" I said, "You name the place and the fighter, send me a ticket." So they called me up. They said, "You're fighting Cleveland Williams in Houston, Texas," which is his hometown. And I go to town to Houston, and I beat Cleveland Williams pretty handedly. And Terry Daniels got the Frazier fight, and Cleveland fought George Savallo on the same card, and then no one would fight me again. I ran into those problems a lot of times in my career, you know. And the same thing happened when I went out to fight a guy named Manuel Ramos, who was the champ of Mexico and was ranked in like top three in the world. And they were looking, George Parnassus was looking to make an Ali fight with Manuel and Ali. And I had went to The mistake that he made is I had went to Africa to fight a guy, and I was in Africa for a month, and I was training, and I was in pretty good shape. And I beat this kid in Africa, and they called it a draw down there because they were mad because they wanted me to stay there and box out of Africa. And so I beat this kid pretty good, and they called it a draw. So, but 11 days later, I fought this Manuel Ramos in L.A., and knocked him out in the seventh round. And they, again, I'm ready now to fight Ali again. And they offered me a picture in the movie business to call The Great White Hope with James Earl Jones. It was the biggest movie in Hollywood at the time. And Raymond Patriarca from Rhode Island put the deal together because they wanted to get me off the street. And the producer, I said, "No, I don't think so, man." And because I thought I was going to fight Ali, but no one would fight me again. So the next fight I had, which was about 4 months later, was with George Foreman. But I was already back in the street doing what I do. And, you know, when they talked about the Foreman fight, I think I trained 6 or 7 days for it.
Are you literally saying that the other fighters were afraid to fight you?
A lot of them, yeah.
Wow. And that's because you hit so hard, or
I could fight.
Rocky Marciano and you just kept bullying ahead?
I could fight. No, you got to understand. So I was big. I was fast. Hmm. I had very fast hands.
4.6 speed. Yeah, we got that.
I could fight, you know, and I had a lot of experience in the street fighting, and I had a great teacher, Rip Collins. So I could fight. There was no two ways about that. And people knew that. And I, you know, when I was California heavyweight champion, we tried to get a match with Jerry Quarry. And I even said to Jerry, I said, look, we'll do a deal. You win one, I win one, then you're on your own. But I had too much left hand for him. I could, you know, and he knew that.
Jack, I'm going to ask you a hypothetical. Got to go with this hypothetical. You fight Ali. Tell me the results. 15 rounds. What happens?
Would have been interesting.
Prediction? Been very interesting. Prediction?
We had a good shot.
All right. Fair enough. In other words, you might have gone the entire 15 rounds and could have gone either way.
Yeah.
Okay. Fair enough.
We had a good shot. Would have been an interesting fight because, like I said, you know, I would have went away and trained the way I was supposed to. And
right. No more 6-day preparations. Yeah.
And he knew I could fight, and he knew because he watched my career. I mean, here I am in San Diego. Okay. And I just, after the Norton fight, and I knocked out a string of guys. And one of the guys that I'm fighting is a guy called Rockman Ali. And I get a phone call from Muhammad. This is how the Muhammad Ali fight and I came about. I get a phone call from Ali. He was with a friend of mine, Gene Kilroy, who was in his corner all the time. And he calls me on the phone. He says, you got to do me a favor. I said, I'll do you a favor. Sign a contract to fight me. He said, you got to do me this favor and we'll talk about fighting. And I said, what's the favor? He said, you're fighting my brother, Rockman. I said, Rockman Ali's your brother? He said, yeah. And you got to get him out of boxing because he's insulting me. And I said, okay. And he said, if you beat him, we'll talk about a fight. And that's how the fight between him and I mustered out. And because I knocked the kid out in the ninth round and he never fought again. And, he honored it. We made a deal. We had a contract, and then the thing with Norton came up. Norton's people went to Chicago with a bunch of money and gave it to Herbert Muhammad, and Muhammad was fighting all of a sudden Kenny Norton in San Diego, and he called me on the phone crying. He said, "I don't know how to tell you this," he said, "but I have no control over it.
Yep,
I have to fight Norton."
You mentioned that you turned down a big boxing movie role, but you didn't turn down two other infamous roles to act in Superman as the villain Nan. And you acted with Christopher Reeve. So tell us about that.
Well, my movie career started with a film. When I finished boxing, they called me up again to do a film, Farewell My Lovely, with Robert Mitchum. And I did a screen test, and Mitchum said, it's either him or I don't do the movie. So Robert became my mentor, and you couldn't ask for a better mentor in life than Mitchum. He was brilliant. Great. He was brilliant. And Farewell My Lovely came out very well. It was a good, very good film. And from Farewell My Lovely, I did King Kong, and I did a film, March or Die, and the crew from March or Die were the same guys that were going to work on Superman. And Gene Hackman and I did March or Die together. So they flew us both up to London to meet Richard Donner because they offered me the Superman movie. And Donner and I talked about the movie, and he said, this guy Nan, the character Nan, had been lobotomized and he was a mute. And he said, you know, how do you feel about playing that kind of a role? I said, I embrace that because Jackie Gleason was a friend of mine and did a movie called Jigo that he won an Oscar for, playing a deaf, dumb mute. And I said, if I ever got an opportunity to play that kind of character, I would embrace it because he shows body language and physical ability to act.
Following the Great One is a good move. Anything the Great One did.
And so it worked out pretty. And what better movie to do that kind of character? Because you had Terrence Stamp was a vicious general. Sarah was a man-eater. Somebody had to relate to the kids because it's a big child audience in the film. So I took this brutish guy and I played him like a child. learning how to work his eyes and getting jubilant when he did something right. And, you know, and it evidently worked out pretty well, you know.
And, you know, I saw this infamous clip, and it was Christopher Reeve, who was being interviewed by David Letterman on David Letterman's show. And David Letterman asked Christopher Reeve, how does it feel to work with, a legend like Marlon Brando? I think everybody was expecting Christopher Reeve to just gush about Marlon Brando, but he didn't. He basically said that Marlon Brando, he felt, phoned it in. He really wasn't passionate. He wasn't motivated. He didn't feel.
Are you serious?
That's what he says on. If you look at the, you look on YouTube, you will see that clip of Christopher Reeve.
What? That's typical, Christopher. Christopher was young and immature, and that was the first big movie he ever did. And I'll tell you, Brando and I were good friends. He knew my father. He knew my backstory. He couldn't wait to meet me, you know. And Mitchum had told me, he said, go down to the set and say hello to Marlon and tell him I said hello. Tell the bum I said hello. And Marlon Brando was incredible. I mean, when he walked on a set, you could hear a pin drop, you know. And he lost a tremendous amount of weight to do that role. So he looked really good. And he did. He looked terrific when he did the role. And he had a magic about him. He was like Mitchum. And I worked with a lot of great actors in my career. And Brando was, here's a good story. I went down one day to see him work on a set. I'm on a set and I went down to see him work. And he's doing a shot. And there's cue cards everywhere, man. I mean, Jesus, God, they were up to that. And so I'm watching and something happened with the camera. And the camera guy said, we got a flaw in the camera. We'll have to come back tomorrow. And then Marlon said, bullshit. He said, I'm going to turn around. You fix that camera. When you got it fixed, I'll come back in and do the shot. And they did. They fixed the camera. He came right back in and he finished the shot. I never saw any actor ever do that before. So when he came down off the set, I said to him, man, I imagine a lot of people would be very nervous asking you this question, but what the hell? What's with the cue cards? I said, are you that bored in the industry that you have to have cue cards everywhere around you? He said, no, man. He said, I started that with Mutiny on the Bounty. He said, I just didn't want it to look like I sat up all night devouring a script. I wanted to make it look like I was taking the words out of the air. And I looked down and I laughed. I said, you're so full of shit. And he laughed. And he was a great Shakespearean actor. And he ripped off a couple parables of Shakespeare perfectly. And he looked at me and he said, that you must know word for word. This stuff, piece of cake. You know, Marlon was one of the nicest guys. And he was in, listen, he worked 11 days. He got paid $4 million to work 11 days.
Not a bad.
They needed to get him on camera so they could go to Italy and get the money to do the movie. He had to be on camera. So the first 11 days of shooting were with Marlon Brando. And he shot all the footage that was necessary for 1 and 2. And the Salt Kinds, how do you cut Marlon Brando out of a movie?
Yeah, right.
They cut him out because they didn't want to pay him the points. They had already paid him the salary. And that's where the Donner Cut came from. If you've never seen the Donner Cut, you should watch it. The Donner Cut is very, very good.
Very interesting. Well, look, his role in The Godfather speaks for itself. Maybe the greatest acting role ever.
Brando is an amazing actor.
Yeah, absolutely.
And an amazing individual. Good guy. I like Marlon a lot.
So, Jack, I think my listeners here are probably thinking about your past growing up, the interesting, we'll call them characters and people that you grew up with that you learned a lot from. And there's misconceptions, you know. You, in fact, told me off the air that none of these people are there to target people who are, you know, innocent people who are, you know, just minding their own business, walking the street. These are things that happen between one family and another family. But what I really want to know is you personally. And I want to know how you evolved. And I want to know how you became a more spiritual person. And when did that start?
Well, you know, I was raised Roman Catholic. And I don't know if you know anything about Catholicism, but in my first when I was in grammar school, I was in a choir boy, altar boy, all that jazz, man. But I did the nine first Fridays, which is a big thing in Catholicism. And I did that for like 6 years in a row. So I got very close to the religion, to where a belief factor was instilled in me, you know? And then as I got older and I ventured into the world and ventured into a lot of things and saw a lot of hypocrisy involving churches and this and that, things that happened in Nam and other places that I've witnessed, the death of people, you know, and how it's, and I questioned the fact, well, you know, if there's a God, why does this happen? Why should these people who didn't ask to die, but then again, when you stop and think about it, they were eager to go to war. They were eager to be a part of it. So the ramifications of being a part of it are what the outcome is. Like anything you do in life, you walk down the street, you know that if you participate in something, you have a part in it, in yourself. And you have a free will that this power of what you call God gave this being that walks down the street a free will to choose whether I want to participate or whether I want to walk away, you know? And when I had a clarity about, oh man, must be almost 40 years ago. I had a clarity and a wake up call as to, you know, where are you going, man? What are you really doing? And I sat down with some people in Italy, in Rome. And I expressed my feelings about, you know, if this religion was so powerful and everything, and this God was so powerful, why did I, you know, and the guy looked me right in the eye and said, Jack, this God gave you a free will. You choose whether you want to participate or don't want to participate. It's up to your spiritual individual self as to how you want to live your life. And that was a great awakening to me, because, you know, I can walk into a place and somebody's scared to death and say, boy, you know who that is, man. Oh, you know, you don't do this. You don't do that in front of him. You don't do things like that, boy, because his reaction is not going to be favorable for you. Well, I allow that to work for me today, so I don't have to bother playing with people. You understand what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And I don't put myself in situations where I know things could happen, because that's my decision and the freedom of my will. And I live a very spiritual life, and I believe in spirituality very strongly. And I believe that people have the free will to do right or wrong. You know, you really have the ability to say no. You know, the littlest language in the English language, the littlest word is one of the hardest words for people to say. And oh, no, I'm not doing that today. I'm not living my life that way today. And to do the best that you can, because who knows what's really after this world, whether heaven and hell really exist, or what kind of punishment there is, or what there is here or there. And, you know, if you live your life to the best of your ability and you live in a spiritual manner, nobody says you have to be a holy roller or whatever. You need to have the ability to allow yourself to be honest with you and to be the person that you want to be in the day. And I choose to be a spiritual individual. I believe that, you know, somebody up there is looking after me. Or I wouldn't be alive at 77, trust me when I tell you. And I've thought about that a lot of times. You know, we talked about earlier about, you know, people coming out of the woodwork and everything. And all those possibilities were there. But for some reason, it didn't happen. And I believe that somebody up there likes me and has kept an eye on me, you know, because I've done a lot of the right things a lot of times in my life and allowed people to walk away because it was my choice.
So you could have made some bad decisions easily, but you chose instinctively and through some good learning along the way to go on a more spiritual path, as hard as that may have been at the moment, right?
Yeah. And there's times, you know, there's revenue streams that I've walked away from. opportunities that people say, oh man, you could have owned this and owned that. I said, but for how long? What are you going to have?
What price?
You're going to have that power for a couple of years, and then you're in a gray suit with bars in front of you for 30 years.
Yeah.
And there's not, let me tell you something, all the money in the world is not worth doing one day in jail over.
That's a powerful statement there, Jack.
Not worth it. I mean, when you're talking about taking your total freedom away, and all that money that you think you have, where are you going to spend it if you're in there?
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, boy.
To make a choice. And people have looked at me and said, yeah, but you could have been this and you could have been that. And I said, I already am that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't need to wear a tag on me. I don't need, I've done my actions. My actions in my life have given me the surrounding security that I probably need, really. You know, but I believe that a man has a right to make a choice as to what he does in his day. When he opens his eyes in the morning, he has a way of living his life that's up to him. And if he doesn't take control of that, then he's going to be miserable, and he's going to worry about the decisions he makes, and he's going to fumble through his life wondering if he made this wrong decision or that wrong decision. And I just give it up to the guy upstairs. You know, listen, if it's meant to be, it'll be.
Yeah. So don't give in to the temptation. Make a better choice.
Yeah.
Stay out of jail.
And, you know, all you got to do is look yourself eyeball to eyeball in the mirror and ask yourself, who are you, man?
Mm.
You know, what is this day about? Are you going to be the fool's clown of the world? Or are you going to be the individual who says, I'm living my life this way today, and that's the way it is? If things are meant to be, and I put the effort into it, and it turns out okay, I put the effort into it. It turned out okay.
Well, I love that lesson. You know, don't take the shortcut. Don't give in to temptation. You know, we've all been there, haven't we, in some way or another, and those that deny it are probably fooling us. We've all had the temptation. It's a choice.
You know, when you get down to the reality of it, the shortest distance between two places is a straight line.
Absolutely.
You know, and a man taught me that when I was young. Meyer taught me that. The shortest distance, Jack, to get from A to B is a straight point line. If you go off on a sideways over here and think you're being clever, it's going to take you longer to get down that street, and you may never get there. Because one of those so-called clever moves you make may wind up deterring you for a long time somewhere you don't want to be.
Huh.
You know, so when you sit down and people have a hard time being rigorously honest with themselves as to whom they are and what they really want to do. And everybody has an ability of some sort. They just got to figure out what it is that they want to do and what it is that they're meant to do. And if they put the energy into that, it'll happen. Whether they like it or not, it'll fall in place. Whether they embrace it and use it, that's up to them.
Figure out the straight path, because it's too hard to go the other path, and it's too big of a price.
You know, I turned down a few movies, like I told you earlier, but when they came up with Farewell, My Lovely, and I looked around where I was sitting in a bar playing pool. I owned a couple construction companies that were involved in foolishness. And I said, you know, maybe this is the way I need to go in my life. And I chose to go and do the screen test and to pursue a career. And it was meant to be, it would be, and it evidently was meant to be, because it worked out extremely well, you know. And I got hooked up with a guy called Robert Mitchum, who was one of the most well-read men I ever met in my life. This guy, wow, what a recall this guy had, you know. So I learned, and you learn from everything you do, you know, every step that you take. And what really is great is being able to do movies. I can live any life I want in front of a movie camera. You know what I mean?
Well, I love your story, because it teaches us a lesson. It doesn't matter where you start. It doesn't matter where you were to even up to now. You can still make a choice. It's never too late. You can go on that straight path.
That was the beauty of doing Superman. You know, I felt that here I could give kids a reason to feel good, a reason to smile and laugh, you know? And I get so many letters from people that, boy, my children, they played the role of Nan. They loved that role, and, you know, and it means that I did something right to give people an opportunity to see this big, brutish guy didn't have to be tearing everything up and everything, but had a way of relating to children.
What a metaphor. Yeah, this big, brutish guy, and yet, you know, you don't have to be what this sort of image of that is. You can turn that into something positive. That's just a powerful lesson. Well, I think you're a pretty amazing individual, Jack. You've got an incredible story. We can go on for days. I can tell you that your stories are remarkable. Each one of them could be a movie in itself. I think we got three movies here, but you do have your book, Family Legacy, which I encourage people to go out and get. And also look out for Jack's miniseries. That's going to be a doozy. And thank you, Jack, for being on the show. It's been a pleasure talking to you today.
Well, that's it. You're coming in the miniseries. And I got a rule just mapped out for you.
I'm there. You know, I want to learn from you. I can tell you that. You had your mentor, Jack.
I sure did. And
thank
what
you
a great
so much.
Mentor he was.
Yeah, thank you, Jack.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks so much for tuning in. We love our listeners, and we believe you have greatness within you. If you'd like The Motivation Show, we appreciate you subscribing, rating, and reviewing us. Check out EliMarcusSuccess.com to hear more inspiring shows and to read our motivational blog. That's EliMarcusSuccess.com.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.